My name is John Beck, and with my colleague Kurt Dewhurst over at the MSU Museum, I co-direct our Daily Work of Daily Lives. And what I just handed out to you is fresh off the copy machine this morning. If you flip it over, the front is our description of what we try to do in our Daily Work of Daily Lives. And the back is next year's Brown Bag Series. And we're kind of fired up. It's going to be a great year of different activities. And what I always tell people, like
so
my friends at Greenwoods
and
Dorothy and others who and Char, who are just such devoted attenders, is hang it on your refrigerator and then automatically get them in your calendar. And that way, you know, just who cares about things like European trips or other things that might get in the way? Why let that stop you? Under our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives, we've been cooperating between the School of Human Resources and Labor Relations and the MSU Museum with this program for 20 years. And under that program, we do concerts, film openings, we do poetry and fiction readings, we do this Brown Bag Series, which is going into its 18th year, and we also do exhibits. And the reason I mention exhibits is because we currently have an exhibit up over at the museum. So when you're done here, walk across, and in the foyer, we have an exhibit called Sun Up to Sun Down, selections from the Our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives collection. Number of paintings, prints, three-dimensional objects, all having to do in one way or another with either depictions of work or art by workers. And it's really fabulous, many American pieces, including some names that are well-known. Clementine Hunter, one of the greatest African-American self-taught artists of the 20th century. Ralph Fasanella, who will have the centennial of his birth next year. He passed away, unfortunately, in late 1997. And Ralph, actually, we did a 14-painting exhibit of Ralph's work across the street years back. But we have two pieces currently on exhibit of his. Jack Kehoe Steele, a Finn from the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, who came down and worked in the auto plants, got a degree at Cranbrook, and was a modeler, actually, I think, for the Ford Motor Company. A variety of other things. So come over and see the exhibit. One last announcement is that all of these brown bags, at least the last few years, have been recorded. And within a few days after them being recorded, they are cataloged and put in the MSU card catalog. I always call it a card catalog, right? I'm a dinosaur. The electronic, you know, online catalog for the MSU library. The beauty of it is you can actually go to the catalog, and right in the center of the description, you have a listen to the recording now. You can hit on that, and you can actually listen to any one of the brown bags, I think, for the last 3 years, Rick? 3 years now we've been doing it? And we were having a conspiracy in the back about going to video. You know, again, we're slow learners, but we come around. So let me introduce, I'm going to actually ask people just to pass back and whoever doesn't have them, please, you can have a copy of the schedule. They make great fish wrappers, too, if you want to take extra ones. Now, I have to tell you that Gary and Aaron, since they're writing about the Upper Peninsula, they know that I'm a Uper, too. We actually decided to make Gary feel at home by throwing a Houghton 4th of July kind of weather for today's talk. But Aaron Goings from St. Martin's University, which is on the Olympic Peninsula up in the Northwest, and Gary Conanen from Michigan Tech University up in our own Keweenaw Peninsula, from peninsula to peninsula, have worked together on a forthcoming history of the 1913-14 Michigan copper strike. And obviously we're coming up on the centennial of the strike, which started July 23rd, 1913. And when I was raised in the Upper Peninsula, I never heard about the 1913 Michigan copper strike. And I had to be a sophomore at Michigan State University in, for many of you who are locals, Lash LaRue's Econ 305, which was a course on labor and industrial relations. And that course, and specifically finding out about that strike, which I found out in Boyer Murray's Labor's Untold Story, changed my life. It's what put me in ultimately into the labor movement and what ultimately brought me as a professor at Michigan State University. So the new history of the strike is unbelievably important in a variety of ways. So I'm going to let Aaron and Gary tell you their version of that, but I'm going to tell you when it's forthcoming from Michigan State University Press. It'll be out this summer. It's a very important book because of the fact that it fills in pieces of the story that really need to be heard in ways that make it very, very accessible to all of us 100 years later. So today we have Aaron Goins and Gary Connanen who are gonna share the podium and the talk today. Wage Slaves and Radicals, Writing a People's History of the 1913-14 Michigan Copper Strike. Please help me in welcoming them to the library and to MSU and to the colloquial series here at the library and to our daily work of daily lives. Yeah.
Well, thank you, John. That's a very nice introduction. And I have just gotten texts and emails back from, I bring you warm, well, cold greetings from the Copper Country. Just got some texts and emails back from folks back home, and we're in the middle of a blizzard up there. There's about 9 to 10 inches of snow. So coming down here, actually, it kind of feels like Cancun, so I'm just going to mark this off as spring break. So it's been nice, but thank you to John for having us. Thank you to the library for having us. Thank you also to Julie Lohr, who's sitting there, who has graciously offered to work with us and publish the book. We went through some interesting challenges. Aaron, of course, lives in Washington, and I live in Hancock, so it's been interesting. And I think we could maybe write a book on geographical writing across spaces or something like that, because there's been a lot of Skyping and IMing and things like that. So it's been a really unique collaboration, and we're really happy to share some of the things that we have learned from our research. Did I forget to thank anybody?
I think you're doing okay.
Okay, good. So we want to talk briefly about kind of an introduction. The name of the book actually is Community and Conflict. We started off with Wage Slaves and Radicals, and then moved to Community and Conflict because we wanted to make it more kind of an encompassing history of the strike. But we wanted today to talk specifically about elements of the strike that perhaps haven't been covered before. So we're sticking with Wage Slaves and Radicals. And we're going to kind of intermix some discussion of writing a people's history. Aaron's going to talk a little bit about what that means to write a people or kind of a working class history of the strike and some of the sources that we used and ideas we had when we initially started writing the book. But first I want to kind of give just a little bit of a introduction to the Copper Country. I'm going to show hands here how many people have been up to the beautiful Copper. Well, I'm just going to skip that then. No. It's good. It's a wonderful area. And I'm actually from Minnesota. So I'm a transplant. I've been living in the Copper Country for about 7 or 8 years now. But just to give kind of some context and some placement here, we wanted to include this map here and give you kind of a geographic idea of actually how much space the Copper Country strike covered. It goes from way down in Onondaga County in the Mass City area, all the way up close to the tip of Keweenaw County. So well over 50 to 60 miles were encompassed during the strike. So just a broad geographical area of conflict. And when we talk about community, we're really talking about the mining community. So it's, you know, looking at it as kind of community as one community is not quite accurate. We're looking at it as kind of a broad geographical area that was enclosed in kind of this mining community that was so prevalent at the time. And so you can kind of see what's going on here. We have some of the major cities and the major towns. Probably for the purposes of the talk, three mining companies and three mining areas are going to be prevalent. Calumet and Hecla Mining Company, which was one of the largest mining companies in the world in the late 1880s, was losing a little bit in its bid to outproduce United States copper companies. It was losing a little bit to Butte, Montana area, as well as some of the Arizona, Bisbee Mine in Arizona. But Calumet and Hecla was the big producer in the area, followed by the Copper Range Company mines, Baltic, Tri-Mountain, and Champion, and then followed by the Quincy Mining Company, Old Reliable, because it paid dividends to stockholders for over almost 30 years. So these are kind of the three big companies where a lot of the pitched battles between organized labor and management occurred. And you can kind of see that oftentimes these conflicts came where you have the stars there in the municipal areas, because these mining companies, they were often compared to kind of closed kingdoms, and the men who ran the mining companies were often, especially in the labor press, referred to as the czars of the copper country. And so what's kind of unique about the copper country, when you kind of place it in context, it wasn't exactly like some of the coal mining regions of Pennsylvania and West Virginia. The workers often weren't paid in company scrip. They weren't necessarily indebted to the company through those types of measures. But the paternalism or the kind of welfare capitalism that was practiced in the copper country was just as kind of, I want to use the word inflicted, but that's not quite the right word. It was just as kind of prevalent in the copper country, but through much less kind of noticeable means. And so you had companies producing things like, of course, propaganda, but also workers were living in company houses, they were bathing at company bathhouses. So all of these things that were designed to keep and retain skilled workers and families. And so on the outside, of course, that can look like quite a good deal for everybody involved, but there's that kind of underlying aspect of control. And we argue that that underlying aspect of control was one of the significant factors that's often not brought up in other histories, was one of the significant factors coloring the labor relations that were occurring in the copper country at the time. So these municipal areas like South Range, Hancock, and Ameek were areas that overtly weren't controlled by the mining companies. They were social spaces that were off mining company property, but of course there was a lot of mining company influence. Mining company managers sat on school boards, county boards, local boards, and exerted influence even over the municipal areas that weren't technically on mining company property. But these municipal areas is where workers built their social halls, where they organized from, and all of the WFM locals, of course, were located in these areas. Like South Range had a Mass City had a WFM local, South Range, Hancock, Calumet, and the Ameek area. So that kind of paints the picture of the social spaces and this idea of community that we're working with a little bit in the book. And now I'm going to, Aaron's going to come up and talk more about the community aspects of the strike.
So thanks again for coming today. Gary and I have been working on this book for a very long time. And of course, as Gary mentioned, writing a book like this did present a number of challenges, geographic and otherwise. But one of the very first things that we noticed in writing a book on the Copper Country, a region called the Copper Country that has very understandably the copper mining industry as its best known industry, and which has as one of its best known events this 1913-1914 copper strike, we noticed that in spite of all these things, labor historians hadn't researched or written about the strike in very much detail. So we set out from the start to correct what we saw as something of a deficiency in the historiography of the Copper Country. We set out to write a labor history of the region, one that placed the region's workers and class relations at the center of its history. Well, it didn't take very long for us to discover a rich history of working class organizing, of community activism, and of workplace resistance by the working people of the copper country. And it's quite understandable why so much emphasis would be placed on the miners, the people who mined underground, people who were associated with the mining industry. But of a region with roughly 100,000 residents, only 15,000 were actually mine workers. So we wanted to dig around and produce a more full, a more complete picture of the labor history of the region. And we were able to uncover a pretty impressive history of working class organizing, not just minor organizing, in the copper country. Now, I suspect this comes as something of a surprise for those of you who are familiar with the historiography of the copper country, because very few people have looked at the history of labor organizing in the region, with the exception of the mine workers. A quick anecdote might help demonstrate this point. When we started out researching this book, I was digging through the Polk City directories of Houghton County and the surrounding counties, and I couldn't find any unions listed in there. Now, I had spent years and years researching labor history in the Pacific Northwest, and unions were always listed. Sometimes dozens, scores of unions would be listed in the Polk City directories. So I asked a local historian in the copper country why there were no unions listed, and he said, well, there were no unions in the copper country. The mine bosses wouldn't allow them. Well, I couldn't accept that. I just sort of assumed that person was wrong. And we dug, and we dug, and we dug, and we actually discovered a really impressive history of worker organizing in the copper country. In fact, we found no less than 33 unions founded, organized in the lead up to the 1913-1914 strike. I'm sorry about the small print. I didn't really know how else to get them all on there. And this list does include two miners' unions, but the rest are not miners' unions. So 31 non-miners' unions, representing at least 2,000 copper country workers by the early 1910s. And they represented, as you may or may not be able to see here, workers who labored in all different sorts of industries. They represented carpenters, barbers, longshoremen, and store clerks. But these workers were not content to simply pay their dues and go to an occasional union meeting. Instead, they were very active in the community, holding parades, picnics, publicizing union-made goods, holding mass meetings. And they were picture is the best for what I'm going to talk about. And they were most visible on Labor Day. Every year from the early 20th century up till 1913, hundreds and then thousands of copper country workers would turn out on the streets of Houghton and Hancock, as well as in Ontonagon County, to celebrate something that they saw as their day. They would march through the streets. This is an early photograph, but later Labor Days, the parade route would be full of non-marching copper country residents and working class supporters. This description of Hancock's Labor Day from 1913 demonstrates just how large and how impressive these turnouts for Labor Day were. It's from the Miner's Bulletin, published by the Western Federation of Miners during the strike, and it says, quote, Labor Day at Hancock witnessed the largest gathering in its history. The miners from Painesdale and South Range formed in parade and marched in celebration, the former walking 9 miles to reach the parade. Barraga longshoremen were there in natty uniforms and probably presented the best appearance of any body of men in the long line of march. The brewery workers carried a large sign advertising their strike against the Park Brewery. They were also on strike in 1913, and admonishing the thirsty not to drink park beer. The day was devoted to education. There was no place or opportunity for games. The crowd seemed intent on learning the significance of Labor Day and listened to a discussion of labor's problems. Many of the same Copper Country workers who turned out to support the labor movement on Labor Day each year would also turn out to support Copper Country strikes. And most Copper Country strikes were waged by miners, by mine workers in general. But they were not the only people who struck. In 1905, unionized employees of the Houghton County Streetcar Company waged a two-month-long strike against their employers. They struck because employers were using a blacklist to fire union activists. And during the strike, large crowds, initially in the hundreds and later in the thousands, would turn out to declare their support for the strikers. They signed petitions stating that they would not ride scab-operated streetcars. They greased the tracks to prevent the scab-operated streetcars from running. They attacked the scabs who drove the streetcars, and they placed obstacles such as large chunks of ice and beer wagons in its way to prevent the streetcars from operating. Now, while the history of the labor movement, the history of the union movement in the Copper Country is rich and diverse, and by the early 1910s, unions in the Copper Country had started to represent immigrant workers, including Eastern European and Southern European, Croatians, Italians, Finns in large numbers. And I'm not just talking about the miners' unions, but all unions. They had also begun to include large numbers of female workers. But perhaps equally impressive, perhaps more impressive, was the long, rich history of radical organizing in the Copper Country. In the book, we refer to these groups as troublemakers. Sort of a sarcastic use of that term. The socialist movement had an exceptionally rich history in the Copper Country. And that's particularly true of the immigrant socialist movement. In the years leading up to the Great Strike, Germans, Italians, and Croatians, as well as the Finns, all formed their own foreign language branches of the Socialist Party. The Italian branch of the Socialist Party even had their own newspaper called La Sentinella, published from 1895 to 1907. But the largest body of socialists in the region by far were the Finns. In fact, the center of Finnish socialism, perhaps the center of Finnish American life, was in Hancock, Michigan. This image shows the headquarters of Tiomias Publishing Company on the left, and then next to it is Kansankoti Hall. The hall was headquarters of the Finnish socialist movement. Tiomias Publishing Company was where the Finnish socialists published their daily newspaper that was distributed all throughout the United States, had thousands of subscribers, very impressive publication. But they also published all of these Finnish language and other socialist publications. Gary did some good work making this chart. One of the publications here, and the one that's the easiest to read for non-Finns, actually I guess there's two, but the English language newspaper, The Wage Slave, an official publication of the Socialist Party of Michigan, was published by Tiomias beginning in 1908, and it was published by a man by the name of Alexander M. Sturton. He was the editor, and he was also the 1908 gubernatorial candidate for the Socialist Party of Michigan. And readers all throughout Michigan received The Wage Slave, and they used this publication to read about local, statewide, national, and international labor and socialist issues, as well as Sturton's colorful editorials, such as this one from 1908. Sturton said, quote, "Let us get busy then and organize into great industrial unions, competent to strike and stay, that's the word, not to strike and leave, as the manner of the craft unions is. Get busy and build the IWW, let the industrial workers of the world. Let every miner in the country join the Western Federation of Miners, and let the Western Federation of Miners swing into line and take its place where it ought to be in the IWW." Here, Sturton is advocating that the Western Federation of Miners, that Gary will be talking a little more about here in a minute, and that, in fact, workers throughout the country should be joining the industrial workers of the world, sometimes called the Wobblies, frequently called the Wobblies, actually, an industrial union and revolutionary organization founded in 1905. And that was actually somewhat active in the Copper Country in and around 1910, 1911. Sturton actually moves on, and he's one of the more prominent socialists from Michigan during this period. He moves on and is the founding editor of the IWW's weekly newspaper, Solidarity. He moved from Michigan in 1909 to become the editor of Solidarity, published in Newcastle, Pennsylvania. So again, the Wobblies were somewhat active in the Copper Country, founding locals in and around 1910, but they remained, for the most part, outside observers during the Great Strike of 1913-1914. Instead, they provided publicity for the strike and even harassed scabs on their way to the Copper Country from places like Minneapolis. Sorry for all the text, but this is just a great article written by Wobblies during the strike, talking about how Wobblies participated in the strike. It says, quote, "A lively fight ensued yesterday between a bunch of strikebreakers and IWW men. The scabs were on their way to Calumet, Michigan, to take the places of the striking copper miners. They were met by some of our members, who told them not to go to Calumet to help defeat the striking miners. But these rats wouldn't listen to argument, so a more forcible language had to be applied. The IWW men gave them a dose of direct action with such telling effect that they went to a doctor instead of Calumet. During the fight, one of the scabs drew a gun, but he was overpowered and the gun taken away from him. The police arrested two of our fellow workers and the gunman. The charges against fellow workers John Delaney and Julius Hansen was assault and battery. The Kangaroo Court today found both of them guilty. Sentence, 10 days in the workhouse. The charge against the gunman was dismissed and, quote, his honor, end quote, stated that the scabs had a perfect right to carry guns. How is that for justice?" So again, the Wobblies remain mostly on the outside during the Great Strike, leaving it to the local workers of the Copper Country to wage the strike with assistance and leadership from the Western Federation of Miners. And with that, I'll turn it back over to Gary.
Okay, so I want to start talking about the conflict that was occurring in the area, giving a little bit of background first about the Western Federation of Miners, or the WFM. The WFM had very radical roots in the West. It was founded in the mid-1890s, and it really was familiar with some of the labor wars that were occurring in Colorado and even Butte, Montana. In fact, Butte, Montana was WFM country. The union had made pretty successful inroads into the area. Then in 1905, it became kind of a founding member and joined with the IWW. And then in 1907, left the IWW over some ideological differences, I suppose they could be called. And then around 1910, had joined the American Federation of Labor, the AFL. So the WFM kind of had an interesting history, and it kind of corresponds from this kind of crescendo as being known as a violent kind of Western labor union, interspersed with kind of this move towards respectability in joining the American Federation of Labor. So by 1911, the WFM was trying to distance itself somewhat from its radical background. And by the time that it was up in the Copper Country, the WFM had a pretty strong advocacy of nonviolence. And that was preached. It's been Mother Jones, who many of you are probably familiar with, came up to the Copper Country, and one of her kind of famous quotes that was included in the labor press was, "Keep your hands in your pockets, boys." It's the one place that James McNaughton, who is the manager of the Cabinet Hackland Mining Company, it's the one place where James McNaughton can't get to him. The idea being, if you keep your hands in your pockets and you stop work, the mines are going to stop working. But it was always kind of a nonviolent message that the WFM was sending in the Copper Country. Not to say, though, that there weren't acts of violence perpetrated by members of strikers, but we really want to make the distinction here, talking about conflict, about what was going on, these kind of random acts of violence, especially on the first day, that were occurring by members associated with the WFM. It was not something that was sanctioned by the WFM. But as we move along and get closer into the strike, we see that there is this thing that becomes known as the institutionalized violence that was occurring from Houghton County, both Houghton County law enforcement officials, but also sanctioned by the mining company, and in many instances perpetrated and kind of propagandized by the Citizens Alliance, which was a vigilante group organized in December. And so we really want to think about this. This picture that happens to kind of be on the template here is a strikers' parade, one of the groups that was brought in by not only the Copper Country law enforcement officials, but also by the mining companies, were Waddell Mahone Detective Agency. And they were hired and employed by Houghton County Sheriff James Cruz to aid and assist in keeping peace in the Copper Country. And as we see in some later events, they were there for one reason, and that was to break the strike. It became especially clear as the strike wore on, of course, that Houghton County law enforcement officials were working in connection with copper mine managers to break the strike, not to be arbiters of peace, but to, you know, put an end into the strike. The Michigan National Guard was also called up by Governor Ferris, Woodbridge and Ferris, who was governor at that time. And we find them also working with copper companies, meeting oftentimes in the offices of the Copper Country, mine management. But so we had conflict that was occurring daily. The strike was I don't want to over-dramatize anything, but it was almost, there were wars in the streets, and you can almost see the, some people within the WFM were considering this a class war. and you had pitched battles in the streets, you had propaganda on both sides, you had generals for the WFM. It was Charles Moyer, who was the president at the time. For the mining companies, it was James McNaughton, who was the manager of CNH. But you can see from the picture on top there that, you know, this was something that was daily occurring. Daily there were parades through streets. There were people up on soapboxes making speeches. And there were confrontations between the Michigan National Guard, between area law enforcement officials and strikers. And so this was something that was not just kind of a sporadic thing that happened every once in a while. Daily, there was some type of conflict that was going on in the copper country. And so it was being expressed in many ways, in the streets, but also in the labor press. The cartoon down there shows the aforementioned James McNaughton right here as Monkey and the Citizens Alliance kind of creating a bridge for McNaughton to go over and pick the golden apples off of the tree, supposedly, you know, kind of a metaphor for the golden apples being wealth that was produced by laborers. So this was something that was not only occurring in the streets, but it was occurring in the labor press. And the so-termed KEP press, the Daily Mining Gazette, and some other newspapers in the copper countries were pointedly advocating end of the strike and a return to normalcy where the copper mining companies were able to kind of dictate what was going on through the system of paternalism. But then, so kind of the first signs of violence that we see are the Sevierville shootings and the shooting of Margaret Fazekas. The Sevierville shootings happened in late July. They were especially kind of notorious because it was Houghton County law enforcement officials coupled with Waddell Mahone Detective Agency officers or detectives that went to a house. And you know, varying on the account that you use historically, there was some type of conflict going on between people that they had followed to the house and then tried to arrest because they walked over company property. And the one thing that is pretty indisputable is that the six deputies who were trying to arrest the two strikers in kind of in the to the side of the house there ended up shooting into the house with nary a warning and ended up shooting two strikers, Eloise Tijon and Steve Putrich, both of whom ended up dying. There was a baby being held in the arms of its mother that had gun burns on its face. And the strikers didn't have any weapons, there was no ammunition, nothing like that found in the house. And so for this pretty wanton act of violence, these six people were later arrested. They were, according to labor press, allowed to kind of roam around for a little while, then were later arrested by Sheriff Cruz, but who had employed all of these people, of course, put into jail. Four of them were charged with manslaughter. One was and didn't serve more than, I don't think any one of them who were charged with manslaughter served over 5 years, and I think the longest sentence was probably 3 years. One was let go, case was dismissed, and one absconded. Now, one of the kind of interesting things that we found through research is the one who was absconded, who was charged with murder, actually was, by January, in New York, still spying on the WFM and working for the Calumet and Hecla Mining Company. And so a lot of the stuff that I want to bring up that we started with the idea of looking through the labor press and kind of doing an interpretation of the strike that came directly through labor press and labor sources. But as we got into the sources and started looking at mining company materials, we found that I was quite shocked at some of the things that were coming out of the mining company's own sources. And this thing about, his name is Thomas Raleigh, who was the guy who had absconded after shooting these into the house and being wanted for murder. We find correspondence between him and a secretary at the Calumet and Hecla Mining Company, and the secretary was then forwarding on this information to higher-ups at the Calumet and Hecla Mining Company. So we have a wanton murderer still being employed by the Calumet and Hecla Mining Company, writing back to people at the Calumet and Hecla Mining Company, and still harassing the Western Federation of Miners in New York. So in some instances, and this is kind of that idea of institutionalized violence, some instances And in this instance specifically, Calumet and Hecla Mining Company was protecting the whereabouts of a person wanted for murder. Again, with the case of Margaret Fizikas, she was in kind of a strike parade, and there was a confrontation, this time with a group of Houghton County deputy sheriffs. And she was kind of in the back. She was a 14-year-old girl, was in the back of the parade. Things got heated, and again, we have differing accounts of what occurred. But when things started to get really bad, Margaret started running away after the Houghton County deputy sheriffs had pulled their revolvers out of their holsters. And according to them, shot in the air, but Margaret Fizikas was a 14-year-old girl running away from the scene, was shot in the back of her head. And luckily did not die, but there are some really compelling accounts. One of the doctors who was on the scene that treated her said that parts of her brain had oozed out of the back of her head as he was working on her in kind of a makeshift hospital that they made in a small shed on the back of somebody's property. Margaret ended up living, but the doctor said her sanity, wrote in this report, her sanity is liable, that she probably wasn't going to ever be the same again. So, and this, the shooting of Margaret Fizikas happened on Labor Day, actually. So, and these were kind of the first instances of violence that occurred on kind of a smaller scale. And then we have a junction being put on the strikers. It was later lifted by a jurist, the circuit judge, Patrick J. O'Brien, who was somewhat friendly to labor. But then we have what we've called kind of this December campaign of intimidation and violence that was occurring in the copper country. And again, the labor press was talking about it, was printing things in December, but much of the material that we've come that kind of indicts copper companies and the Houghton County Sheriffs and the Citizens Alliance comes from their own archive. This is not stuff that was being made up in the labor press. This was handwritten letters from mine company managers to higher ups in the president, in this case, of the Calumet and Hecla Mining Company. I was actually quite astonished. I won't say the actual word I said when I read some of this stuff, but I was in the archive where you're supposed to be quiet and wasn't appreciated. But I was just flabbergasted at some of the material that we were finding. And so we really want to hone in on this December campaign of intimidation and violence that was occurring, because it leads into the Italian Hall, as you'll see here. There was a decent-sized force of labor spies that were being employed by the mining companies to look in on what the union was doing. Some of them had absolute access, like operative number one was posing as a socialist journalist from Denver, Colorado at the time, and was going to all of the meetings that were being held by the WFM local in Calumet. So of course he was a journalist, so he was writing. You know, he was doing what journalists did at that time, was writing everything down. So we get pretty remarkable and accurate depictions of what were happening. So 7 days before the Italian Hall tragedy, which occurred on December 24th, Christmas Eve, 1913, 7 days, a labor spy reported that there were two letters threatening the union store in Italian Hall. And really, we see that as this kind of December campaign of violence, which started mostly on December 10th and started kind of ramping up from the quote there you see from Charles Lawton, the earlier quote you see from Charles Lawton, really started ramping up. And by the 24th of December, then kind of the sad and tragic crescendo to that December campaign of violence occurred. And I want to speak a little bit about why December. Why did this kind of reckoning, this 2 weeks of reckoning occur? Well, the mining companies originally had thought that the strike was going to be a short affair. They wanted to let the strikers get it out of their blood. They wanted, you know, let them do what they want to do, and then they'll come back and we'll have labor peace. Strikers stuck to their principles. And you even see James McNaughton, who is probably the most powerful man in the copper country, writing back to his president, Quincy Shaw, back east, that he was feeling blue at the time. This was in October, that he can't imagine that the strike is still going on, and he's depressed, and he wants to talk about it with people. And so not only was this feeling of kind of real sadness on the part of the mining companies occurring, but also financially the mining companies were being impacted. They were finding that strike wasn't going to happen, the strike wasn't going to be stopping after the snow started to fly. They had figured that the Copper Country winter would send the strikers back into their homes, send workers back underground, and that wasn't happening. And by December, the mining companies had essentially had it. And so we're using this as that idea as kind of the catalyst behind this December campaign of intimidation and violence, which led up to the Italian Hall tragedy. And we really want to take a look here at the Italian Hall, a fraternal and benevolent organization. But the key to understanding aspects of the Italian Hall is that it was a multi-ethnic organization. It was really a testament to the work that the WFM had done in the Copper Country of organizing kind of this multi-ethnic working force. And so there were Finns, Croatians, Italians, people of all different ethnicities that were in the Italian Hall at the time. And just kind of a quick background, if you aren't familiar with it, in mid-afternoon, even some of these facts are not concrete because of the chaos that was occurring. But sometime in the mid-afternoon of December 24th, at a Christmas party that was occurring for striking workers and their families, especially the children of these families, that was put on by the WFM National and the Calumet Ladies Auxiliary of the WFM, someone is supposed to have, and we argue that there's pretty strong evidence that it did occur, run up the stairs of the Italian Hall, this building right here, into the hall area, which you'll see yell fire maybe once, maybe twice, and then run back down the stairs. And when looking at the material culture, kind of the physical evidence at the time, we want to kind of say that, you know, there's a lot, it's multifaceted what occurred at the Italian Hall. And we want to look at the building for one of them as being kind of a part of the tragedy that occurred at the time. So here's that second floor hall area that you've seen earlier. And here's the actual hall floor space, the stage and scenery. But then what really becomes important is into this area, which was about 71, the sides of the building measure about 71 feet by 40 some feet. Into this space in the hall here, there were reportedly anywhere between 300 to 400 people into that small area of space. And then when that person came up into the vestibule there off of the stairs at kind of the top, you see at the top left-hand corner, the stairs up into that vestibule, into the hall, call a fire. And then all of those people, and remember, it was multi-ethnic affair, so a lot of these people had never been in the Italian Hall before. And so you have all of these people upon hearing that cry of fire, and we have some historical precedents for this, the fire that occurred at the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory that perhaps a lot of these people knew about. This call of fire, which, you know, I mean, that's a pretty dire thing, sent this group of possibly 300 to 400 people, many of them not knowing any other point of egress, streaming out of the building and down through that vestibule, which you can see is a small and confined space, and then down those stairs, which were roughly about 5 feet in width. And so you have just this absolute scene of panic and chaos that was occurring at the time. Some really interesting stories that come out of it. This floor plan is in the book, but where you see the number 6, the numbers indicate various stories that we have picked up on and that kind of correspond to the stories that are occurring in the book. Number 6, you see that kind of oblong object there. There were the Sneller brothers. One was 7, I believe one was 5, who were caught in the panic. And somebody from the building that you can just kind of see, the building across the street there, which was a laundry, somebody from the second floor laundry took an ironing board, smashed the window, and put the ironing board across the space in between the building to the side and to the Italian Hall. And Frank and his Frank was the older boy, and his brother actually walked across that ironing board to safety on the other side. The guy who had broke the ironing board through said, you know, grab your brother's hand and lead him across. And so you have a, you know, in this absolute scene of chaos, you have a 7-year-old boy leading a 5-year-old boy, grabbing the hand of somebody who is sitting in a building next to them and leading them across to safety. And so you have other acts of heroism that were going on inside the hall, but sadly and tragically, anywhere from 73 to 79 people who had cascaded down the stairs ended up suffocating and losing their lives. We use that number of 73 to 79 because the documentation process at the time and some of the, you know, people were scared of Houghton County officials. So there is this idea that perhaps that number could be even higher because some people took their dead home and buried them off site, didn't bring them to the coroners. So even that number, 73 to 79 people, that's not a concrete number. But it's the best one that we really have at this time. So 73 to 79 people ended up dying. 60 of some were children under the age of 14. There were at least 2 or 3 babies in mothers' arms that had perished. And a lot of sibling groups. There was at least 4 or 5 sibling groups. The Klarich girls were one of them. None of them over 12 or 13 years of age that all perished in the Italian Hall together. So just a tragedy of really epic proportions that became national news. The strike was already national news, and that's one of the connections that we attempt to make in the book is this was a local event, but it was national news. It was of national scope. Not only strike, but especially the tragic events that happened at Italian Hall. The labor press of the area, though, picked up on the story immediately. Duomius, as you can see there, you know, you don't have to be able to read Finnish to understand what's going on. And they were quick to claim and quick to write that this was, you know, this was part of what was going on in December. And we found some pretty concrete evidence both before the event, like those labor spy letters, but also some pretty concrete evidence to suggest that this was a planned event. And again, probably the most concrete piece of evidence that we are working with is Calumet and Hecla Mining Company hired its own labor spy to go and hunt down the person who supposedly yelled fire at Italian Hall. So this was the mining company, in essence, opining or thinking that there was an actual perpetrator at Italian Hall. And we see in their records his hunt for the person who cried fire at Italian Hall. Some can speculate as to why the mining company would hire somebody to track someone down like this. Maybe they were altruistic reasons, but as you can see, as some of the things that happened over time, I postulate, and this is my own opinion, that they were trying to figure out if people could in fact somehow connect them to the events that happened. So they employed this labor spy, and the labor spy did a good job. Daily reports, again, back to the people at Calumet and Hecla. And he finds a guy that he goes into and interviews. Sits down with the guy in the house that he was boarding at and talks to him. And he doesn't come out, of course, the guy that he's interviewing doesn't come out and say, you know, I did it. But the labor spy is talking about how the guy is fidgety. And so there's all these things that kind of clue him into the fact that perhaps this was the guy. But the correspondence sadly ends before the labor spy makes any final conclusions. So while that was occurring, later in May, the WFM local in Calumet had its own search on for somebody who cried fire at Italian Hall, and they think they had found out, they had located the guy who was the perpetrator of events, and it happened to be a union turncoat. And there is a really kind of interesting group of, I'll call it the clan, there is an Irish group, not the clan like we know the clan, but a kind of an Irish clan, who were in Keweenaw County that were very pro-labor, the Dunnigans, Irish ethnicity. And the Dunnigans fingered this guy and said, this is the guy, he was supposed to be a union organizer, he was a turncoat, and you know, we gotta go get him. And so they made some attempts to go get him. He fled to Minnesota. And then they were making attempts in May to try and bring the guy back from Minnesota. Again, that correspondence, and this is all coming from company sources, from labor spies, that correspondence ends before we find out if the union had ever got their man. So, and this is one of the things I think that we have been able to add to the historic record. There weren't a lot of primary evidence as to what was going on, especially related to Italian Hall. And we've been able to kind of include some of these new perspectives and new findings that we have come up with. And here are some more kind of the tragic scenes that had occurred at Italian Hall. The picture to the top left there was seen in the labor press. And then just, after 2 days after Charles Moyer, who had come back into the copper country, was beaten, shot, and then deported, put on a train by a group of some 40 or 50 people. Nobody ever stood trial for that. So by that time, the Italian Hall was a crescendo, but by the time that Moyer was beaten and sent out of the copper country, you know, you can imagine what was going on in some of the strikers. But the president of their union, nationally known figure, had just been beaten, shot, and sent out of the copper country. So really we see after, and this was kind of the end of that December campaign, that as Ryan Walker, who is a nationally syndicated cartoonist, portrays here, things in Calumet, but the copper country in general, were out of control. So thank you, and we'd like to please, if you have any questions, we'd be happy to answer them.
Now, I'm going to hand you this microphone before you ask a question.
Should we go to the front?
Or?
Now I'm on. Okay, thank you, John. So if you raise your hand, let me start handing the mic around.
When was the National Guard called in? Was that after the Italian Hall incident?
No, the National Guard was called in very early. This is good question. Thank you for asking, because it kind of places things into context. The National Guard was called in very early after Sheriff James Cruz had determined that he couldn't handle the situation anymore. And the entire Michigan National Guard was sent up to the area. They were, I don't know what the formal military term is, but they left the copper country early in October when it was decided that things had kind of quieted down. And really at that time, Houghton County law enforcement officials were kind of left to their own devices. And we see kind of, Aaron has described it in the book. I don't know if any of you have ever read any of Jack London's work, The Iron Fist. We see the Iron Fist kind of coming down on the copper country in December after some of the, and the, you know, again, the correspondence that we've found between McNaughton is really telling, because this was affecting him. Early on in the strike, they were kind of joking about it and saying, let them do what they want. But by the time late October, early November rolls around, there's a really a decline in production, but also there's a frustration on the part of management that the strike hasn't ended yet.
I'm curious if in all your research that you undertook and what you uncovered, if there were any particular, quote, facts, unquote, that you disproved. In other words, some common beliefs that you just found to be wrong.
Well, I probably shouldn't say this, but that local historian that Aaron was talking about that didn't believe there are any unions in the copper country, that's this guy. So he disproved me wrong. So that's one. I told you should tell them, but I feel an ethical.
I can only throw you partway under the bus.
Okay, thank you. I feel kind of an ethical responsibility to let you know that was me.
Well, but let me just challenge you guys, because the fact that Art Turner is probably the best known, his Rebels on the Range is the best complete single history of the strike. And really, your argument takes on Turner very, very strongly in relation to, he really thinks of the Copper Country as this unbelievably strong community, the hearth, and that the radicalism is outside that. Your interpretation is really turns Turner on his head in that way, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, in a few ways. In the first place, Turner does believe that the strike is this product of outside agitators, and that's actually very common to, for lack of a better word, non-labor historians writing about labor history, is this belief that strikes, especially these radical, long strikes that are very common during the first two decades of the 20th century, that they are the product of outside agitators. Outside agitators either meaning foreigners, immigrants, or people shipped in from New York City, in this case, the Rocky Mountain states, or in my other research, they always seem to come from Seattle and go out to the Olympic Peninsula to stir up trouble. But what we tried to demonstrate here, and I think we did pretty effectively, is that there's this long history of bottom-up organizing by the workers themselves in the copper country, organizing unions for decades, striking for decades in the lead up to the Great Strike. In addition, the argument that this is a product of outsiders, outsiders meaning immigrants in this case, the copper country was almost entirely first and second generation immigrant by the time the 1910 census rolled around. So any argument that this was somehow created by un-American radicals really is, you know, it's tough to make that argument because the people who were doing most of the work, who were creating the wealth of the copper country, were in fact first and second generation immigrants. So do you have anything to tack on to that?
I think it's important. I don't want to get too theoretical, but I often try and think of history as a mosaic. So you have a lot of different, in any type of event, you have a lot of different perspectives going on. History is an empirical, it's not necessarily scientific, but it's empirical. You're dealing with documents or buildings, material culture, whatever it may be. So you have a lot of different viewpoints. In strike, you have the mining company viewpoint, you have the striker's viewpoint, you have Charles Moyer's viewpoint. You have all of these competing viewpoints that are kind of coming together. We thought that it was really important because most of the literature in the area of this hadn't brought a real bottom-up approach. And if some of you have read E.P. Thompson, it's that style of trying to tell labor's history through labor sources and sources that are going to complement the perspective, because that perspective often gets overlooked. And so that's why we really are calling it a working class history, because that's the perspective. And we want to, you know, and I think that's fine as long as you make your bias known. If you make your bias known and this is where you're coming from, you're not trying to trick readers. And we're not trying to trick readers in that this is the overarching, encompassing history of the strike. This is a working class viewpoint of the strike that we're trying to get across, and it also happens to be the viewpoint that hadn't been covered so far.
Sure. Some while ago, there was a program offered by John and the museum on that.
Thank you. Some while ago, there was a program on the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire and the escalation of support for anti-smoking legislation. Would you feel that the Italian Hall tragedy spurred federal legislation in any way?
What do you think?
The short answer is I'm not sure. The longer answer is that there was a legacy that rippled out after events at Italian Hall that affected the local area. Today, there are many people still within the community that trace some type of memory, public memory or something like that, or personal memory, excuse me, back to the event. Because just by the sheer number of people that were affected, this was significant. So on the local level, it was important. State level, of course, it was very important. And then the national level, it became very important through various media outlets. Whether that directly affected national legislation, I'm not entirely sure.
I'm also not sure. And I think one of the reasons why it might not have affected national or statewide legislation in the same way as the Triangle Fire, which we do talk a bit about the Triangle Fire because they're both these horrible tragedies occurring only a couple of years away, is that there wasn't necessarily a long-running campaign to pin the blame of Italian Hall on anyone, certainly on any forces from above, as though it was the fault of employers. It was mostly dealt with as a tragic accident, and that was really passed along. I think perhaps if it had been viewed as a of an act of anti-worker violence, then perhaps it would have led more directly to pro-worker legislation, pro-union legislation, progressive legislation. But again, that's speculation, and so the short answer, I think, is the best one, that we don't know.
Now, I've got a couple of questions right here, but let me just say to Shar and anyone else, remember that the 1913 Michigan Copper Strike was one of the first involvements by the U.S., the new, brand new U.S. Department of Labor.
Right.
So that there already was, in the progressive era, an interest in labor legislation and in actually sending federal investigators in, which was a brand new thing with the 1913 strike. And Calumet really got on the map because of the Italian Hall situation. Suddenly there were all sorts of investigations, there were countless kinds of people coming into the copper country that were spurred, frankly, by the tragedy. Without the tragedy, the strike would not be as well known as it is today. So right down here we have a couple of questions.
What were the initial terms sought by the strikers? What were the sticking points for management? Did they ever get to any kind of bargaining at all?
That's an excellent question. The initial terms were really, you kind of had two different, and this led to some tension within the union. There were kind of two different ideologies going on. There was kind of a bread and butter unionism, where wages, working hours, condition. Some of the initial terms were eight hour day. They were working sometimes 10-hour days. Increase in wages, the elimination of the one-man drill, which was a labor-saving device, which would have cut the skilled workforce in half. And then also the big one, the recognition of the WFM as bargaining agents for the miners. Mining companies, and this is, I think, maybe an area where Aaron and I might differ a little bit. I really see an undercurrent of rank-and-file unionism that was kind of IWW-inspired. Because the local WFM locals, which were populated by a lot of Finnish immigrants who were pretty strong members of the IWW, sent letters ahead of the WFM nationals' wishes, sent letters to the mining companies kind of saying, this is what we want to meet. According to historical sources, the mining companies sent the letters back, many of them unopened. Most famously, Charles Lawton of the Quincy. And there's a little bit of it's contested a little bit whether it's happened or not, but he's famously said to have sent his letter back unopened, like, I don't even have the time to read your mail. So there is this little bit of a kind of a rank and file unionism that was driving these actions that were occurring. And so they weren't going to recognize the WFM, and the WFM National didn't really want a strike to occur, but it did end up happening, and then they ended up throwing all of the WFM's resources behind the strike. But the kind of the key sticking point then would have been recognition of the WFM as bargaining, and that never happened. And in fact, that didn't happen for over 30 years, till the WFM basically was broken by the strike, reorganized as an international union of mine, mill, and smelter workers, and then finally in 1943, was able to organize the copper country. There was probably already on the horizon an eight-hour day, so that was instituted at many of the larger mines and smaller mines after legislation came through. But depending on who you asked again, there was a bump up in many mines at wages. And so the WFM was in a lot of their newspaper said, you know, it's not a total loss. And I really don't think it necessarily was. There was a bump up in wages, the 8-hour days. So there were some concessions that were unofficially given to striking workers, but the major sticking point was recognition of the WFM, which did not occur.
And again, this is, I think that last point, something that's important to really hammer home, because this is so common to strikes, certainly of the 1910s, is that we've got radical unions to one degree or another, radical unions, IWW, Western Federation of Miners, and others. And the strike is led by those unions. The unions don't end up getting recognition, and many of the strikers, especially many of the leading activists, end up killed, deported from town, or blacklisted. So they don't actually get to enjoy these bread and butter gains, as Gary described them. But the majority of the workers do. So the struggle actually does achieve gains, but it's just not. They're not enjoyed across the board, including by many of the leading activists.
Another key component to all of this is the hierarchy that existed along with paternalism. Not only was it socially, there were English-speaking mine workers that were kind of favored, but existed underground. And so one of the WFM's biggest jobs during the strike was taking the skilled workers, who were often Cornish, sometimes German or American workers who'd speak English, and getting them together with the immigrant workers who were mostly working unskilled jobs, because there was a pretty solid labor hierarchy that was occurring in the mines as well. So bringing all of these people together at once to speak in one collective voice was difficult, and it was a tense union between some of these competing ethnicities. And it was one that actually started to fracture a little bit towards the end of the strike. I'm not exactly sure, but of those 73 to 79 people that perished in Italian Hall, I don't think there's a Cornish or an English speaking person among them. So you see that it was largely, you know, the unskilled laborers, trammers, timberers, other unskilled jobs in the mine, timber boy, you know, kids that were working in the mine, where they had led a lot of this kind of activity that was going on before the strike, and then during the strike, they were kind of the leading force. And because this one-man drill was going to be instituted, it brought skilled labor together with organized labor. But there was always that tension that was kind of operating between the solidarity.
Now, we're going to take a few more questions. I've got them here.
Yeah, I was interested in what the actual evidence is that the person who yelled fire was put up to it by the employer, if there is any, or is it you're somehow, I take it your assumption is that the company, maybe I'm wrong, but I gather that from the tenor of your remarks, is probably behind this, but if that's true, and I don't want to mischaracterize what you're saying, what's the basis for it?
Excellent, and that's a poignant, a really important question. So we have the context of some of the threats that were being levied. We don't have a direct link from the mining companies, from mining, letters or correspondence. We don't have anyone saying, hey, you tell so-and-so to go run up the stairs. That we don't have. We have the context that occurred before, and then the coroner's testimony, because there was an inquest held into the event, the coroner's testimony that people saw this person wearing a Citizens Alliance button, ran up into the hall, yelled fire once, maybe twice, ran back down again. And then we have the labor press taking journalists, taking statements from people after the event. And then afterwards, we have this labor spy who was employed by the Calumet and Hecla Mining Company that was employed, and it's this we do have documentation of. He was employed by the Calumet Hecla Mining Company through a detective agency, Foster's Industrial and Detective Bureau, employed by the Calumet Hecla Mining Company to find the person who yelled fire at Italian Hall. And so that was his job description. And
was there anything in the documentation that you found, that you suggest,
company had an interest in putting an evidence guy. That was the purpose of it or not? Or is that just...
Well, we're...
was that your son's bad interest in finding this guy and doing away with him or quieting him somehow? So if he had been put up to it by the company, that would come out. I just wondered if that's your argument. Is there something that company documentation?
Well, we didn't intend to make the argument that the company put a person up to doing this. In the book, and I think in the presentation, we've suggested that that's certainly a possibility. There's some hints that that might have been the case, but that's not the argument that we're making. We're not arguing that this is a case of company-directed mass murder or anything along those lines. We're merely trying to add the new documentation to the story and interpret what it says. So I think.
And in fact, we state quite clearly in the book that a definite answer to this tragic event probably is never going to occur because there's too much chaos, there's too much tragedy. But one of the things I think that I feel pretty comfortable in stating is that there is a good deal of documentation that the Italian Hall was a premeditated event, that there was a definite targeting of Italian Hall as a place where union activity was especially strong, and that there were threats being made to Italian Hall, so that this event wasn't just some happenstance accident, and it was a part of this campaign of violence. We cannot connect dots directly to one person doing it, one person, and that's kind of the point that we try and make, that even though we found this primary documentation of things that were occurring, an answer to who cried fire at Italian Hall and naming it on somebody is probably likely never going to be there. And that's difficult because as human nature wants us to say that's the guy that did it, but there's too much time and too much chaos and reporting and all these things that were occurring at the time to ever, point the finger at somebody and say that is undoubtedly the guy who cried fire at the Italian Hall. And that's not what we're trying to accomplish.
Let me borrow the mic for 2 seconds. I have the pleasure of having read the book. They had the pleasure of writing the book. One argument that they make, just so that we put it in perspective, and I think Gary's saying it, but let me say it even stronger, is Italian Hall, just like to the 911 terrorists who took down the Twin Towers, Italian Hall was emblematic to the community in terms of its place within radical politics and union politics within the Copper Country. So the run-up, much of the run-up is really about the idea that if anything is going to happen in this community, one thing that we really have to do is we have to make strong statements. One of the strong statements is to do something in effect about Italian Hall and about the kinds of activities that go on there,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So in that way, I think that what their argument in the book is given that kind of presaging, no one probably went out of their way to create mass murder. Did someone go out of their way to create huge unrest and huge kind of confrontation on Christmas Eve 1913? The answer probably is yes. They probably were just as horrified by the ultimate result. No one goes out of their way to try to kill children. Well, I would hate to say that people do, but in this case, I think it's they were out to take down, in effect, the symbol of the strike in a place where many of the strike meetings and other things had happened. Is that correct?
Yeah. I think it's pretty clear to me and to us that the idea was to make a disturbance, something to disrupt the events that were going on in this place that, as John has said, was emblematic. And what happened after that, there certainly isn't documentation, but I don't think that you can, cast what happened afterwards as somehow a causation or causation before. I don't think you can connect the cause and effect that this person would run up the stairs, know that he was going to create the deaths of 73 to 79 people. We haven't found any documentation, and before we make any assertions, we want to be clear that that's not in the historical record. But that's it's a great question. It's an important one.
I have two questions. One is, I thought you said that the mining companies made housing available for the miners. Mm-hmm. Was there any movement to oust the miners from the houses during the strike?
Yes, there was. And it was kind of an interesting, because not only did the mining companies have some real high-priced lawyers, the WFM also had some pretty high-priced lawyers. And while the mining companies were serving eviction notices, very few people were forcibly evicted from their homes. Few people left on their own volition, but the WFM lawyers interceded, got injunctions against the evictions, and at one point you see one of the Calumet Heckler Mining Company lawyers writing back to the company saying, you know, this is really pointless, because by the time it gets to court, the strike's probably going to be, you know, they can appeal it, By the time it gets to the court, you know, it could be 1930, you know, so there's really no point in forcibly doing this. And so there was an attempt. It was kind of checkmated, I don't think that's a word, but checkmated by the WFM lawyers, and for the most part, people stayed in their homes.
Okay, thank you. And the second question is, how did the strike end? Did the WFM just say it's over, or did it peter out, or end at different areas?
Well, it ends in a lot of different ways, and I think that's a really complicated response. One thing that happens at the end of the strike that we touch on briefly in the book that hasn't been discussed previously is how, and again, this is, I want to set this in the national context, this happens all throughout the country, is that the workers, the strikers especially, knowing that they're going to lose, that the strike is all but lost, they form little labor parties, little working men's parties. They start to join the Socialist Party en masse, and they start to try to run for political office. In all of the little local elections throughout April 1914, they win a few of these elections, but the reason why they wanted to some political power is because they had noticed that, at least in their opinion, local government as well as state government seemed to be working at the behest of the mining companies. They wanted some local political power, and they do actually win a couple local offices. So do you want to speak?
But officially the strike ends in mid-April. And there is a vote overwhelmingly by the people that were in the WFM to discontinue the strike. But you kind of see kind of a slow burn from after Moyer's deportation to April, you know, kind of a march down. You see this somewhere in the rhetoric of the newspapers, where, you know, earlier on in the strike and even after Italian Hall, there's this kind of concerted energy about the strike. In April, you start saying, you know, don't give up yet. Don't believe what you read in the Daily Mining Gazette. Don't believe the flyers posted in the Rexall drugstore that the strike is over. And you see some, you know, we've been here with you boys, and, you know, you have already gotten an 8-hour day. It's coming. The only thing that isn't going to be recognized is the WFM as your representative. So you can even see in some of the rhetoric from December to April, kind of this ramping down of what was going on. But April was the official end of the strike. So that was a 9-month conflict. It's pretty impressive.
Let me just make a quick comment on your question, just because I'm a historian of the strike too, but I'm not as well published as these guys are. And that is that Calumet area, there were private homes as well as company operated homes, so that it was intermixed. It's very different than, say, Cabin Creek in West Virginia or the Ludlow situation in Colorado, where when the workers strike, automatically the company turns them out of company housing and they end up living in tent villages. there were no tent villages of that sort. There wasn't this kind of mass exodus to the periphery of town that ends up being a shooting gallery, as in the case of Ludlow. So it's a very different kind of history in terms of what paternalism looks like. It doesn't mean it's not paternalism. It just means it's a different kind of paternalism. They weren't using company stores to the same degree. The cooperative movement had created alternatives throughout the strike. In many cases, when workers were able to get many things either cheap or for free through, again, the Finnish cooperatives and the rest. So it's a different kind of paternalism, but it doesn't stop it still from being paternalism. But the company housing is not used in exactly the same weapon way, and as Gary has already said, because of the fact that they're legal interveners. Now, I see more hands. Let me just ask, if I keep on letting you ask questions, will you stay? I just don't want to see everybody suddenly, okay. And we guys keep on answering, yes.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, by the way, there are sign-in sheets. If you haven't signed in, please sign in, and we will go for a couple more minutes. Here we go.
We didn't get dressed up for nothing, right?
Well, mine's a quick one. I wondered if you're participating in any of the anniversary events this summer or the UP History Conference?
Yeah, Gary's been a pretty integral part in planning a number of those events. I'll be flying out a few different times. So very excited for the UP History Conference.
We are, we're giving one of the keynotes at the UP History Conference. So if you're going to that, we'll try and think of new stuff that we can talk about so you're not bored.
When is that?
That is, I should have this date, late June.
Late June.
Yeah.
The 24th through the 26th, maybe?
No, it's a little later. It's like the 28th. Yeah,
okay.
Saturday, Sunday.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the book will be out.
Okay, the book.
Oh, well, now we know when the book's coming out. Right.
And FinFest is also going on in Calumet in June. You also have Gary's conference that he's running about in October?
Yep, writing Across Peninsula Conference.
So there's a number of opportunities. All 1913 Copper Strike all the time this year. Other hands in the air in terms of questions?
This isn't a question. It's more of a comment as to why the panic was so thoroughly grabbing. Nobody really questioned, is there any fire? This only followed the Iroquois Theater fire in Chicago.
Yeah, that's another
where over 600 people died in the fire. And I think that was something they had in their minds, that you got to get out of here.
Yeah. And there's documentation in the labor press and in the inquest where they talked to people and they didn't buy candles or put candles on the Christmas tree because they were concerned about fire. So there's, you know, where did that shout to fire come from? Again, it's not very likely it wasn't anybody that was in the hall just to be there. It had to be from somebody, I shouldn't say it had, but there's a lot of documentation that it came from somebody outside of the hall because there were measures taken to ensure that they were, like you said, they were aware of that, that it was a concern.
Okay, any last questions? Well, back here. Here we go. This is my exercise program, you know.
Just one quick question. Did the labor press cover it as a tragic accident, as you mentioned it was regarded?
No.
No, a number of different labor publications described it as being murder. And even the New York Times doesn't say that it's murder or even really hint at it, but the New York Times acknowledges that the working people of the Copper Country believed it was murder. And the New York Times has this quote about, if the person who yells fire is discovered, that person's going to be lynched. So certainly much of the labor press, although, I mean, there's hundreds of labor and socialist publications. I mean, there's a diverse array of reactions. But even in the New York Times, we're having comments about the people of the Copper Country believe this is an act of murder. So.
Now, let me just, don't go anywhere yet, two quick announcements. First of all, for those of you who came in late, do come over to the MSU Museum and see our new exhibit, Sun Up to Sundown, selections from the Our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives collection. There are flyers around for next year's programs. Please do come. We love having all of you come to the Brown Bags. Do sign in if you haven't signed in. And let me just mention that 1913 Massacre is a film that was done by Louis Calderi and Ken Ross about the Italian Hall disaster, specifically about the role of the disaster in the memory of the community, but also around the Woody Guthrie song that was written in the 1940s about the disaster. And Guthrie quotes Mother Blur, who was at Italian Hall. She frankly believed that the deputies had held the doors and stopped people from getting out, which would explain in her mind why it was that there was a crush on the stairs, because that they all suffocated because they piled like cordwood on the stairs. And so that film is out, and we'll probably be showing it in the fall again here in town, so do look for that. But let's give them all a round of applause. I'm sure you can bend their ears with any other private questions or comments, but thanks so much for coming.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.